So, some of you may be familiar with the Japanese Zen monk Ryokan, who was also wrote some poetry and was a hermit and lived in a hut out away from people much of his life. And there's a story that tells of him being away from his hut at one point, and he didn't own much, if anything. Lived a very simple life. And while he was out from his hut, a thief came into his hut. And some stories tell it that the thief broke in, but I kind of can't imagine that there was a locked door on this hut with nothing in it. So the thief goes in and there's nothing to steal. But while he's there, Ryokan comes back and sees the thief and says, "Oh my goodness, you came all this way and there's nothing for you to take." So he took off his clothes and he gave him his clothes. And then the thief, probably pretty bewildered, walked away. And then Ryokan sat down, looked up, and said, "Poor fellow, I wish I could give him this beautiful moon." It makes me consider my practice in a particular way. In a way that if I literally lost everything that I considered in any way precious, would I be able to also like offer the remnants of what might be left? And then when the thief left, would I still feel such compassion and care because I couldn't give them the most precious thing, that I couldn't offer them this moon, the light of practice and awakening and possibility? So I imagine that everyone in this room has lost something or given things and has had those experiences. Probably some of you will know that my mother died last year. And a couple of days before that, I was in an online sangha that I'm part of, and we were talking about some teachings of Rob Burbea, who's an amazing teacher who also passed away in the last few years. And he offered this practice of meeting everything, every sense experience you have, every experience you have, meet it with pity. So this mental state of pity, which means joy, energetic joy. So we were having a conversation about meeting our experience with this joy. And we thought, oh, what if we meet it with other qualities that arise in practice as well? What if we also meet it with sukha, with this deep, kind of happiness, this deep, more quiet kind of joy? So piti has more the feeling of the rolling river, and sukha has more the feeling of like the deep stillness of a lake. Or what if we met experience with equanimity? So we had just had this conversation, and that evening I flew to Texas to be with my mom. And as I was laying with her in her bed, she had dementia, so she wasn't really present that those last 24 hours. And I realized in that liminal space, if you've ever been with someone as they're passing, that that is what was happening, that my system, that my being was meeting those experiences with that joy, that deep contentment and happiness, and that equanimity. And I felt so much appreciation for that fruit of practice. There was a sweetness to that, that I didn't have to work to do that. It was just a fruit of practice. So what I want to talk about tonight is that how different things, like sometimes that sweetness is is like the memory of that sweetness and that fruit, tasting the fruit of practice, can be what ignites us into practice, that which keeps us coming back to practice. And there are other things that also can bring us back to practice. So the curiosity tonight is, what can ignite your practice? What can keep you coming back to practice? Is it those moments of sweetness? Not, this wasn't a peak, what you would call a peak experience that you might have had of like, oh, all, everything is love, or we are all one, that are super beautiful. And they come and go. But what are the things that keep calling you back into practice? I had a while back, I came across a film that I watched. I didn't know what it was about, and I'm not sure I would have chosen to watch it if I had known, because it was based on some true life stories that involved some really really unwholesome human behaviors. And while I was watching this film, there was a moment when I saw two paths in front of me. One path would be to go into a place where I've gone before, which had historically been around almost like a hopelessness for humanity, or that like despair almost for humans. And at that moment, another path also opened. So I don't know if you all have, if anybody's read the Dune books, which is a sci-fi book, and there's a state that some of the characters, one or two, get into where they see all these paths into the future. So it's like, here's this moment, and here's all these paths going out from now. And there's this knowing of like, oh, if this step is taken, then it leads to one of these paths. If this step is taken, it leads to these. So I have to do a slight non sequitur here for you to understand what I'm about to say. And that's to tell you a little, just a tiny bit about my current beliefs about rebirth. The way that I currently view this life is that it is a karmic pattern that keeps showing up, not as Robin, not as a name, but a particular human pattern that continues to show up on the planet. And any changes that this pattern can make towards wholesomeness will mean that this pattern shows up in a different way in the future. So in that moment of that film, where I could have chosen to go down this like circle of sankhara, this like repeated thing that I've done so many times historically that leads to like lethargy and all of that, there was this other opening of, oh, some, if this path change, if this changes towards something more wholesome, then down the line, this karmic ball is different. This karmic pattern shows up differently. And that is another way that all of these things change. All of these things can move more towards wholesomeness. I don't know if you're familiar with, I want to say the name right, so I'm trying to find it here, sorry. There we go. Haudenosaunee. The Haudenosaunee are, it's another word for Iroquois. They're the ones who about 1,000 years ago almost started, I don't know if it had been around for a while, but talked about that idea of 7 generations into the future. 7 generations into the future, that what decision you make today, it's a philosophy of whatever that decision should result in a sustainable world 7 generations into the future. Now that's a way to make decisions in this moment, to think 7 generations, and to think about it not just as like external decisions that you're making, but also internal ones. Like, what is your practice? If you're practicing and engaging in practice, what is that doing 7 generations now? In Flagstaff, we have a kind of an unfortunate, I don't know if you've seen this visual, visual of what that can look like, which is, oh, I do feel compassion for this person who started one of the big fires. And you can look on a map and you can see the place where the story goes that they used the bathroom and lit the toilet paper on fire. You can literally see that. And then you see this cone of where the fire went. But what if we flip that and we think of like, what cone of wholesomeness can be lit by this fire, by the fire of my practice? And what does that look like into the future? Right? It can be something so subtle. I mean, toilet paper is not a big fire starter, right? But what if like we do something other than like lighting our shit on fire? We actually light something else fire, right? What does that look like? So one of the ways to think about igniting your practice is thinking about it not so personally, but about, well, what might this look like so far down the line? And it is not talking about letting go of any possibilities of change or responsibility or any of the things like that. It's being even more aware of that. Even more aware of what decisions that I make today without getting caught up in the like, oh, but I can't solve all of these problems in my lifetime by myself because I do X. And you can light that little fire in there that is doing something. And then you're making other action choices based on that as well. And you're looking farther into the future. You're not taking it so personally. You're part of this big flow, this big stream of existence. So there's this great Gandhi quote. Whatever you do in life will be insignificant, but it is very important that you do it because you can't know. You can't ever really know the meaning of your life, and you don't need to. Every life has a meaning, whether it lasts 100 years or 100 seconds. Every life and every death changes the world in its own way. You can't know, so don't take it for granted. So it may be that that idea is something that ignites your practice. In the suttas, there's a piece of this that talks about like having zeal for the arising of unarisen wholesome states. So it might be that you're looking to cultivate more care, more kindness, more compassion, something a more ease in the way that you are with people so that then they're more easeful. It may be that that's part of what's pulling you in your practice, right? And gives you this zeal, this fire. And sometimes we just are trying to get away from something, right? So it's like, oh, I want to be less angry. I want to be less this. I want to move away from these behaviors or internal states. Knowing that even as you're doing that, something else is also being cultivated, but that might be the thing that sparks. So I have a friend who said, you know, if I don't practice every day, my anxiety just goes through the roof. So their spark, the thing that was driving them into practice, was to get some relief from that anxiety. And they also were noticing all these other fruits of practice that were showing up. So we don't have to have, oh, this is the right reason for me to practice. We can find the thing that gets us into the moment, into what we're doing, so that then whatever's happening, whether it's a push away from something or a pull towards something, we're bringing that fire to it. And just as the suttas talk about a zeal towards wholesomeness, there's so many things here that I just want to say it this way. Awakens the zeal for the non-arising of unarisen unwholesome states. So you see there's like a knot and a knot and a knot. But if you think about it, it's like, oh, the unwholesome states, whatever that is for you, oh, the unarising of that, for that to not arise. Wow, that's something like the unarising of the unwholesome state. Oh, unwholesome state. So that might be a part of the drive for practice. That might be a piece of that, like, oh yeah, that. And I want to be clear that words like zeal can sound really big, but sometimes zeal is just a pilot light or an ember, like something that's glowing in there. It doesn't have to be this exuberant thing. It can be just like that warmth in there that gets you coming back to your practice. And by practice, I will sometimes use these terms, formal practice and moment-to-moment life practice. So formal practice is a mind training for sure. And that might be a sitting practice or a walking or standing or lying down, but it's an intentional time when you practice for however long you do. And then moment-to-moment life practice is bringing this intention to either notice the arising of the unwholesome states and let them go, to cultivate the future non-arising of the unwholesome states. Or it might be for you cultivating the arising of wholesome states, but you notice that in your moment-to-moment life practice, so that moment-to-moment life and formal practice are not these separate things. Check, did my sitting practice today? Done. Now I'm going to go do these other things and forget about that. That leads to, well, let me say this another way. It doesn't lead to the fullness of practice that's possible. So being able to recall these things in your moment-to-moment life really can rich things up. The third way that I want to talk about this, bringing your practice more to life, bringing that fire of your practice, is in the present moment. So there's this pull towards something, this push away from something, and then there's just this moment. So quite a few years ago, I was in a doubt spiral. I somehow had just started to get the understanding that there are so many different ways that people practice Buddhism and understand a path towards awakening, that I was starting to get spun of like, what is this? This is too many of those like future paths going on. And they seem to be going apart from each other as opposed to towards from each other. This was just a spin I was having. But what I discovered was, when I sat down to do my sitting formal practice, when my attention came to the breath, this very subtle coming to the moment, everything else fell away. Nothing else was important. All of this scatteredness and doubt wasn't about the practice. It was just a thing that human minds do. It's why it's one of the five hindrances. It's because it's a thing that minds do. And when you can recognize it and not like fall into it so much, then that can be something that comes and goes and passes in all its forms. But again, one of the things that can drive practice is when you come into the subtlety of each moment in your practice and notice, oh, what's important when you're really in that moment? What falls away? It also might look like in the present moment of, oh, when I'm mindful, when I'm actually here more, then I can make different decisions. I can be with people in a different way. Be kinder to myself and to others. That's the body of what I wanted to offer tonight, was this idea of allowing yourself to find the ignition switch, basically, of what can keep calling you back to your practice and that can keep it alive for you. And that if you have those times when you notice that practice, the quality has shifted in some kind of way, can you come back to that? So I want to end with two things. One is a poem by Mary Oliver. This is related to that coming back to the moment kind of spark. Oh, do you have time to linger for just a little while out of your busy and very important day? For the goldfinches that have gathered in a field of thistles for a musical battle, to see who can sing the highest note or the lowest, or the most expressive of mirth, or the most tender. Their strong, blunt beaks drink the air as they strive melodiously, not for your sake, and not for mine, and not for the sake of winning, but for sheer delight and gratitude. Believe us, they say, it is a serious thing just to be alive on this fresh morning in the broken world. I beg of you, do not walk by without pausing to attend to this rather ridiculous performance. It could mean something. It could mean everything. It could be what Rilke meant when he wrote, "You must change your life." So I want to end with the poem that Ryokan wrote following the experience with the thief. The thief left it behind, the moon at my window. So let's just sit for a couple minutes.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.